The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Atlas Butler has convenient 2-hour service windows for heating, cooling, and plumbing service. Because nobody likes waiting around. You listening, BMB? Nobody likes waiting around.
Call 1-800-FURNACE.
Hello and welcome to the Spike Podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and with me in the studio, we have Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And joining us down the line, we're delighted to welcome Spike's columnist, Rakib Ehsan.
Hello.
Coming up on today's show, we'll be discussing Southport and the fraying of Britain, Kamala Harris, the Queen of Cringe, the double life of Hugh Edwards, and the Olympics boxing scandal. So we've had this unspeakable tragedy in Southport this week. 3 girls stabbed to death, many more people in hospital, a town absolutely devastated. It's been overshadowed by some other events, but I think, Tom, should we talk a little bit about the tragedy first, just so we don't lose sight of it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely unspeakable. The cold-blooded murder of 3 little girls, as well as many more people. I think it's 5 children, 2 adults who are still in hospital. It's the details are a little bit unclear, but regardless of what any particular background or motivations that we're dealing with here, you're talking about an act of barbarism, plain and simple. And I think it's really touched a nerve because I think combined with a kind of general sense of lawlessness in the country, I think combined with a general sense that the public aren't trusted to talk about these difficult issues when they arise, these horrible cases when they arise, and also paired with the fact that this is what our kind of second big horrendous law and order issue in the space of a couple of weeks. If you think about the riots that followed this particular incident, this particular horrendous crime, as well as the riots that we saw in Leeds recently, you know, machete fights on Southend. I mean, I think this has collectively left a lot of people in Britain with a kind of impression that no one is really in control.
Yeah.
That the government doesn't really know how to deal with this array of different horrendous violent threats and kind of social fraying which is taking place, and that most importantly that they are not really being listened to and taken seriously in the midst of all of that. And I think whilst we can talk a little bit about the reaction, I think that's the thing that more than anything left a lot of people, not just in Southport but across the country, feeling with a mix of kind of horror, confusion and anger as to what had taken place. And I think it's important that we don't get away from that, because naturally the conversation has been led down a number of different other rabbit holes since the crime itself.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we should talk a little bit about the wrong reaction, the rioting that broke out in Southport and then subsequently in other places. I mean, Rakib, what did you make of those disturbances? I mean, almost as if haven't the people of Southport suffered enough, and then suddenly you have these thugs, marching on the mosque, throwing bits of pavement and bricks around, and setting fire to police cars. It's just unbelievable.
Well, the local residents in Southport were reeling from a truly horrific atrocity, and then the riots took place. Primarily responsible were out of town troublemakers. We've seen that in previous riots in the UK, where a lot of the people involved are not local to the particular area. And the riots saw 53 police officers injured. You talked about the destruction of private property. A local mosque was attacked. And I think we have to mention the fact that following the stabbing spree in Southport, there was a proliferation of anti-Muslim conspiracy theories on online social media platforms such as X. And I think that there was absolutely no evidence to suggest that the suspect was Muslim. One of the conspiracy theories was that it was a Muslim illegal migrant that was behind it, one that had arrived in the UK on a small boat from France. And I think what was really interesting here is that the police have not managed this particularly well at all, Merseyside Police. There's been this sort of drip feed of information. We now know who the suspect is, down to the court system, which made an unusual but ultimately welcome decision to reveal the suspect's identity. But we've seen the police indulge in all kinds of social media activity in the past, especially radical, progressive activism. But when it truly mattered, what we needed was the police to intervene in the social media space and combat that anti-Muslim, baseless disinformation. And they were nowhere to be seen. And a lot of these conspiracy theories spread like wildfire unchallenged.
Yeah. And born of that sort of vacuum of information that you were talking about, because the only way you can challenge disinformation is with the truth, but we weren't allowed to hear the truth for the best part of a week.
That is true. There was a caginess. And I think Rakib has already made this point, but, you know, a more kind of sure-footed response to these things, informed by a trust in the public to be able to deal with that information. I think there's part of the withholding of information is born of a belief that everyone are like those rioters, that if you kind of feed them too much information, they're going to, you know, launch a pogrom against whichever identity group is deemed to be kind of collectively responsible in their minds. And that's not going to be the case. If anything, as we've seen in this instance, the conspiracy theories were allowed to flourish in that particular vacuum. That being said, I think it's fair that a lot of bad actors were persisting in pushing these conspiracy theories, these claims about him being a Muslim, a small boat migrant, etc. And yet it was established basically as of Monday evening that the suspect, who has now been named as a 17-year-old Welsh-born British citizen but of Rwandan heritage, his parents were Rwandan migrants, it was established as of Monday evening, effectively, that he was born in the United Kingdom. I think it was in the next day or so that there was no links to Islam whatsoever. And yet people were continuing to perpetuate these myths. So we're certainly up against a kind of a genuinely obnoxious conspiratorial climate, which is willing to trade in this nonsense. Similarly, I think after the riots kicked off, there was this attempt from a lot of these influences to present a lot of those out-of-town troublemakers as basically just upset residents whose concerns were getting ahead of themselves, completely going against the reports about, you know, where these people are actually coming in from, as well as the fact that, you know, if something horrendous like that happens in your community, you don't start smashing up your neighbor's garden wall to throw masonry at the police. This is an absurd proposition, and yet people are kind of feeding into that. I think in a way they're doing the establishment's job for them, which is to say, at times like this, because there is a desire to squelch down criticism of the authorities, to try and demonize dissent, to try and say that people don't have a right to be angry about horrendous cases like this. And there's often a conflation which has been made by the reaction of a hard right violent fringe and ordinary people who just say that whatever was the cause of this, we need to talk about it. It needs to be confronted. Mm. There's always a desire to conflate those two things on the part of the establishment, because it means ordinary people can be dismissed. So the people who were going around saying that the people who came from out of town and were rioting in Southport were, you know, that was just the voice of the unheard in the community, are doing the establishment job for them, I think, in many respects.
Definitely. And Rakib, I mean, you know, no one really feels as if anyone's in control. And I don't think anyone thinks that Keir Starmer is up to the task of sort of healing the country, to use a sort of hokey phrase. I mean, you just get the sense that he is not prepared to talk about whatever we discover the cause of this to be, whether it's to do with knife crime. That's something that is sort of too sensitive for him to talk about. If it were an Islamist attack, we know that he wouldn't want to talk about that at all. You know, he's no interest in confronting that. What do you think the government can do, or what do you think the future looks like under this government?
Well, firstly, Fraser, there's certain things which are out of any government's control. We're talking about this vacuum. I think much reason why that vacuum exists, which disinformationists exploit, is because there's been the vanishing of effective, independent local reporting, which used to be a very critical part of our media ecosystem, especially when I was growing up, where you saw small town journalists who had their variety of sources, who really took pride in their work, and they were well trusted. In many parts of the country, they've vanished, and I think that's also created this vacuum where you have rabble rousers and agitators exploiting that vacuum. In terms of the Labour government, I think the worry for me is that the reaction to different kinds of public disorder have been somewhat different. Understandably, in the aftermath of the Southport riots, the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, she was very robust and assertive in her language, talking about how violent thugs will meet the full force of the law. You didn't really see that kind of assertive language. She struck a more conciliatory tone after the Harehills riots, in Leeds, for example, which took place after social services removed children from a Romani family. And I also think that when it comes to the Manchester Airport incident, once that later footage emerged of the build-up to the suspended police officer kicking the floored man in the head, we knew then that police officers had been hospitalised. A female police officer was left with a broken nose. And on top of that, you had quite intimidating gatherings outside Rochdale Police Station where you had protesters chanting Allahu Akbar over a perceived form of police brutality. Yet very little from the Home Secretary on that front.
Yeah.
So I think that it really taps into those accusations that in law and order, there's certain groups that benefit from preferential treatment, whether it be the police forces or indeed the UK government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, but of course, ultimately, you know, ethnic minorities suffer even when some ethnic minority people are let off by the police. Because we think about those residents of Harehills, a very diverse area, majority of them would have been, you know, terrified in their homes while thugs were allowed to run amok. You know, this kind of two-tier policing, state multiculturalism doesn't actually help the minority people it's supposed to help.
And also it's got the potential to fuel a sort of nascent white identity politics. The kind of sense, well, this is what this group do and are allowed to do when one of their own, whatever that means, is, you know, arrested or whatnot. So when Tommy Robinson gets arrested, we all need to kick off. We all need to show up outside of the police station. That's the sort of the kinds of arguments you see starting to curdle on kind of sections of the online right now, which shows that, you know, you can't have it both ways. If you want to play the kind of multicultural game, if you want to encourage people and treat people differentially on the basis of group identity, you're going to encourage people to think of themselves in terms of those group identities, including members of the white majority. And that is not a road that we want to go down. And I think just going back to, again, the sort of the horrendous murders at the centre of all of this and the broad public reaction, because we're not just talking about one community. I think it's fair to say this is something which has really touched a nerve across the country. Mm. And I think the reason why we're having this conversation in the context of broader social disorder or broader kind of issues of multiculturalism or whatever is that there's a kind of sense that across various different forms of crime, of violence, of lawlessness, of social fraying, that there are various issues which are having deadly consequences, even for the most vulnerable in society. And the one thing that connects them is that the state is seemingly petrified of even talking about them, let alone dealing with them.
Yeah, yeah.
So whether you are talking about knife crime, whether you are talking about grooming gangs, whether you are talking about the Manchester Arena, what have you, there's a kind of sense that these issues are so terrifying. They touch on such sensitive topics that you almost get the feeling the establishment would rather that kids were being, you know, blown up or stabbed or stabbing each other if it means that they didn't have to have some tricky conversations about how to deal with these phenomena and how to push back a lot of these broader problems. And I think it's bred a sense of like almost, and you saw that really reflected in the heckling of Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
Which again, there was an attempt to even demonize that well before any violence had kicked off in Southport in response to the attack. There is that kind of general sense that the government is so kind of paralyzed by political correctness across a swathe of issues that they're almost turning a blind eye to the deadly violence inflicted on children. And that's why I think this has touched such a nerve. It connects a lot of phenomena for people, I think.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer.
Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
So I want to stick with the theme of identitarianism, but slightly more on a lighter note. Kamala Harris, her campaign is in full swing. There's been questions around her racial identity, but also she's using identity politics to quite a big degree. There's been these two groups, white dudes for Kamala Harris and white women answer the call. Basically these giant Zoom fundraising groups, essentially getting, I think you could say, Rakib, maybe exploiting white guilt to a certain extent, getting people feeling, certain rich white liberals feeling that they must support Kamala Harris because she's a black woman.
Well, I think it's the very silly side of identitarianism, really. The belief that you have to support a particular candidate because they have the characteristics which are favourable, and the identitarian pyramid. Being non-white and also female. But I do think that, I think that President Trump, I think some of his interventions have been quite poor, actually. Sort of attacking Kamala Harris. Oh, is she Indian? Is she black? She's not sure what she is. I think very clearly, Kamala Harris, the vice president, she's been very clear that she takes pride in her black identity, but also her South Indian identity, a black identity specifically being from the Caribbean. Mm. I believe her father, Donald Harris, respected scholar, is of Jamaican origin. So I think that the US, it has a very interesting political culture where you also have groups like, for example, Hispanics for Trump. You have those groups as well. So I think that what the ancestry and in terms of one's personal identity, it does count for a loss, for better or worse, in the United States. But I think that if people want to support Kamala Harris, it should ultimately be down to policy or what her track record is in public office. If there's a white middle class progressive in the United States, they feel that, oh, I must support Kamala because she is a non-white woman, then actually they're not contributing very much to the race relations conversation in the United States, in my view.
Definitely. And well, you talked about sort of her policy, her record. I mean, it's not a good one, is it, Tom? You know, it's very hard to understand what the excitement is about, really, a lot of the time.
Oh, absolutely. And also, she's a bit of a Keir Starmer insofar as she has the courage to hold political positions that suit her near-term goals. I mean, yeah. There was a piece in the New York Times even this week pointing out that since she last made her tilt at the presidential nomination back in 2019, she's changed her position on single-payer healthcare, on border funding, on all kinds of different issues, on banning fracking. She's basically hurtled rightwards, roughly speaking, because of the fact that it's no longer politically expedient. At a time when the kind of Sanders wing was more in the ascendancy, she felt the need to mouth those platitudes. Now she's going, at least trying to kind of present herself as more of a centrist and a moderate. But this is a familiar story, isn't it? The kind of politician who doesn't really stand for very much. Identity politics sort of fills the void, or it provides a gloss to an otherwise uninteresting politician. There's a kind of sense where it almost doesn't matter what I stand for or what my policies are. Won't it be brilliant if I was elected? What that statement that would make for society. I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, even when Obama was elected in 2008, he actually did pitch himself very much as a kind of unifier, you know, given his biracial heritage and so on, that, you know, that was very much the address. Obviously, there was a lot of identity politics discussion swarming around that, but that was the pitch he wanted to make. His rhetoric changed very much over the course of his presidency. But I think the thing it reminds me of more directly is the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016. Very much the pitch was, I know I'm really unpopular, I know a lot of you don't like me, but wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a female president? She would literally put out videos of her breaking through glass ceilings, you know, enlisting celebrities in particular, black celebrities, Hispanic celebrities, millennial celebrities, whatever, to appeal to those specific racial, generational blocks. And we all know how that turned out.
Yeah.
I mean, she lost amongst white women, who, if you buy the identitarian logic, should have been the most inspired by her particular campaign. Donald Trump improved the Republican standing amongst ethnic minorities in that 2016 election, and he continued to do so in 2020, despite Joe Biden's emphatic victory and the fact that Biden had strong support amongst African Americans, you still saw the support for the Republicans amongst Hispanics, Black Americans, Asian Americans ticking upwards. It's actually one of my kind of favorite counterintuitive facts about Donald Trump is that he's kind of seemingly single-handedly reversed the racial polarization of American electoral politics, even whilst being accused of being a fascist and a white supremacist and so on. But I guess what I'm getting at is that, you know, if Harris does pull off an unlikely victory in November, it will be in spite of, not because of, this sort of identitarian politics, which leaves a lot of people cold. At the very least, it leaves a lot of people, including ethnic minority people, thinking, I get that this makes the white dudes on that Zoom call feel good about themselves. Yeah. I get that this will get Kamala Harris the presidency, but what's in it for me? Mm. And I think, as I say, this is something which leaves a lot of voters cold, not necessarily just, you know, the white Americans, people across the piece just think, you know, you're just giving me platitudes here and warm words rather than anything that I can actually get behind properly.
Definitely. And Raqib, I wanted to get your thoughts on the sort of Trump's sort of multiracial populism, because he was speaking this week to a convention of black journalists. It's a very testy and hostile exchange, but, you know, it is true that he has increased his standing significantly among black men recently. And as Tom was outlining, you know, every opportunity improving his ratings among Hispanics. Yeah. I mean, what is the appeal of someone like Trump, who we are told is a white supremacist to ethnic minorities?
Well, I just think building some of the points that Tom already made, that you're quite often by his fiercest opponents, Trump is portrayed as some kind of white nationalist. And then you have people put the sort of MAGA Republicans portraying the Democrats as this wildly minority identitarian party. We actually look in the last presidential election, it was actually white men in the Rust Belt that helped Biden over the line. And if you talk about that Trump's actually done quite, he's not so much performing well, but he's performed relatively well compared to previous Republican presidential candidates and Republican presidents. With certain minority groups. Now, for example, many people are still very surprised when I tell them in the last presidential election, Trump polled in the region of 30% among Muslim Americans. After the war on terror, in the second presidential election that George W. Bush Jr. Contested, he was in single digits. So he's actually brought his party forwards a great deal on those fronts. So it's quite interesting. The Trump-Biden axis was a very interesting era for American politics, because going against much of the rhetoric, they actually grew in terms of popularity with groups you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Yeah, definitely.
And touching on that the black journalism conference that Trump attended, he did receive some very hostile questioning, but I actually thought he held his own. And you know what? Fair play to him, because he actually turned up in person. I know that Kamala Harris was at a different engagement, but I think the optics of her not being there in person, but Donald Trump was, is quite interesting.
So let's talk about Hugh Edwards, who this week pleaded guilty to possessing child pornography. I mean, the images that he, you know, is in possession of are absolutely shocking. Category A images, some of the, you know, most serious, featuring incredibly young children. I mean, Tom, I guess this is interesting because Hugh had so many public defenders not that long ago. He, you know, we were told when The Sun did an expose about him giving £35,000 to a crack addicted teenager, we were told that this is, you know, just his private life, and you know, there's nothing untoward to see here. People said that with a lot of confidence. I felt like it was very strange.
And it is worth saying that the story that was being reported on last summer, primarily by the Sun newspaper, but by other outlets as well, which was when this whole scandal kicked off, as you say, was around this allegation that he had been giving up to, I think it was about £35,000 to the 17-year-old in exchange for sexual pictures. The parents had gone to the Sun because they felt like they had no redress, that it was being used to fund a crack habit. Mm. So at the very least was deeply unseemly and very clearly in the public interest. You're talking about someone who's using their, in part, taxpayer funded wealth in order to engage in some quite unseemly activity. And obviously, as the weeks wore on, there were allegations of inappropriate behavior from inside the corporation, etc. It was something which clearly was, there was a there, you know. Yeah. But because at that point, that particular story, that particular allegation, there was no criminal component to it. It was sleazy. It was unpleasant, but it wasn't criminal. And therefore, as a consequence of that, you had a lot of people saying, well, it's just his private life. It's just a complicated private life, as if there's no public interest defence here. And then obviously the way it ends up with him outing himself as this unnamed individual, of course it was shrouded in mystery originally, and then checking himself into hospital on mental health grounds. It was basically presented by a suite of people like John Sopel, formerly the BBC, now a sort of midwit centrist dad podcaster, Owen Jones, of course, and a few others, as a classic tabloid witch hunt.
Yeah.
You know, this is, there were some people who were suggesting it was a homophobic component to it, et cetera, et cetera. Now, those people can't be criticised for their lack of clairvoyance. The case that has now brought Hugh Edwards to justice hadn't even really begun and was entirely separate to that original scandal that The Sun was reporting on. At the same time, they did show a sort of remarkable lack of curiosity in that particular story. A suggestion that there was nothing unseemly whatsoever about someone giving tens of thousands of pounds to a vulnerable young person who was using it to buy drugs.
Who hasn't bought sex pictures of a vulnerable teenager to fund a drug habit?
It took on that tenor, what? This is outrageous. And of course, the reason they were doing it was because of the fact that they disliked The Sun newspaper and they quite like the BBC.
Yeah.
So the very thing that they were accusing The Sun of doing, which is that you're pursuing some sort of political vendetta, it was kind of the mirror image of that. And it was particularly telling given the fact that it seemed to cut against their own supposed principles. You know, when Me Too hit Westminster, a lot of the commentariat was hauling people, Tory politicians, over the coals for a fleeting hand on a knee. This, they're like, oh, it's nothing, it's his private life. Owen Jones, you know, tries to get people sacked over saying things, let alone doing things. And yet, in this instance, thought it was absolutely outrageous that there would be any consequences whatsoever to those original non-criminal but still unseemly allegations. So I think it's a reminder that the commentariat, despite often accusing other people of being biased, of being kind of warped by a certain political prejudice, that certainly played a role in their remarkable lack of curiosity, shall we say, in Hugh Edwards' dark double life, which turned out to be infinitely darker than even we realised.
Yeah, Jesus. Rakib, have you got any thoughts on Hugh Edwards?
I actually find it all quite sad. The truth of it, he was a very well-trusted authority at our national public broadcaster. He was also the man who announced the passing of the late Queen Elizabeth II, which was a historical moment in British broadcasting. And now it's just been tarnished beyond measure because of all this. And I think I also remember that I think he spearheaded BBC's coverage of the 2019 UK general election as well. And he brought some very interesting political analysis to the table, especially from Brexit voting Wales. So all of this, I think it's just such a shame. But I think, you know, just put that to one side, the BBC has a great deal to answer for. That they really do. Even if this was a private corporation, you'd expect very high standards of integrity when it comes to these kind of issues. But I think even more so, considering it is a national public broadcaster.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
So there's been a huge scandal at the Olympic boxing on the day we're recording this. Essentially, the Olympics has allowed two boxers. We don't actually know their status. They don't identify as either transgender or intersex, but we know that they have been tested for their sex and have XY chromosomes. So I'm trying to be careful about the language. Not, you know, these are not straightforwardly transgender people pretending to be something they're not. So there's Algeria's Imane Khalif and Taiwan's Ling Yuting. The circumstances around their biological sex are shrouded in mystery, but we know that they do have male chromosomes. And many people would think that that would be enough to raise alarm bells. And on the day we're recording this, the Algerian boxers just had the first bout and the match had to be called off within 46 seconds because of the obvious male-female power imbalance. Now, this is like scary territory. Normally when we're talking about women's sports, it's a discussion about fairness. But when we're talking about boxing, this is about safety.
No, absolutely. And it's one which has recurred throughout the whole kind of gender and sport discussion. I remember one of the first stories that brought a lot of people attention to this was that was the Fallon Fox controversy, which was a trans-identified male who was beating up women in mixed martial arts competitions. And you think this is clearly the situation in which this should be the first sport in which you decide this isn't allowed before the debate managed to rattle through to all of the others. Because as you say, it's not just about unfairness, it's about safety. There is this question mark over these two competitors insofar as neither of them have said they are transgender. There is some speculation that there might be some sort of DSD, some sort of developmental sexual disorder, the sort of thing that Casa Semenya has.
Yeah.
But regardless of what these two things are, if these people have failed a gender test effectively, as they both did at the Women's Boxing Championships last year or recently, I believe. And also, given the fact that some of the reports from women who have faced them before have talked about just how strong they can punch, how it's like unlike anyone that they've ever boxed with or sparred with, this is clearly something that shouldn't be allowed to stand. But because of gender ideology, effectively, because of the fact that the rules and regulations in various sports, including some Olympic sports still, basically makes clear that biology isn't necessarily the determining factor, even when you've got someone who could potentially punch 150, 200% harder than their opponent. This is crazy. Everyone realises it's crazy. I think this is one of those moments one would hope in which it really starts to cut through.
Mm.
That putting women's sport, fairness and safety second to hurt feelings is a terrible idea and leads to a situation in which you've got someone with, at the very least, shall we say, male biology.
Yeah.
Punching a woman in the face, breaking her nose in the case of the...
of Angela Carini.
Exactly. And that's supposed to be fine.
Yeah.
Like this is a real kind of emperor's no clothes moment, I think. Even though there's been many in this sport, this surely has got to be the most severe yet.
Definitely. And Rakib, I mean, the IOC have been questioned about this, but they've just said anyone who raises concerns is engaging in some kind of witch hunt, that they're being cruel, that they're stigmatizing these athletes. I'm sorry, I don't think it is stigmatizing them to say that they should not be in the women's category. Doesn't mean they shouldn't participate. Of course not.
No, and they should. The two athletes that you're referring to, they shouldn't be in the women's boxing competition at the Paris Olympics. It's quite as simple as that. I find it quite interesting because the organisers branded this Olympics as the Equal Games, the perfect demonstration of inclusivity. Firstly, we also have a child rapist in the men's beach volleyball as well. I think that's a bit too inclusive for my liking. But there you go. But I think you raised such a good point. This goes, I mean, of course, we have to talk about the biological reality of it. But there's a very serious health and safety issue here. And I think that's been demonstrated even in this fight where the Italian female boxer was left with a broken nose within a 46-second period. And I just find it absolutely remarkable that this is being allowed. And if this continues, this could destroy the very integrity and fairness of women's sporting competition. And I think it's a crying shame that it's happened at this Olympics.
And Tom, I mean, the Olympics started off with the opening ceremony was kind of a celebration of wokeness. Now we've seen the cold, hard reality of what wokeness leads to, surely. This is what it means to be kind and be inclusive.
No, exactly.
Beating up women.
This is the thing. I mean, that's the great absurd. I mean, you want to laugh, but it's so horrendous at the same time. Is that it's now become a progressive position to be relaxed about a male punching a woman in the face, or to celebrate it even, or to pretend. That's the other thing. The kind of what do you mean? This is a problem. Shouldn't we be more inclusive? It's a reminder of the deranging component, I think, to woke ideology, gender ideology, whatever you want to call it, which is to ignore the evidence of your own eyes and to ignore the obvious injustice which is taking place before you in the service of ideology. It's just incredible that we're still at this point, even with the debate we felt moving on and getting better in so many respects recently.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
For heating, cooling, and plumbing, I trust Atlas Butler. They always text me their location, arrival time, and even the technician's photo and zodiac sign. Just kidding. Looks like a Pisces.
Call 1-800-FURNACE.
Hi, it's Jenny and Bill from Simple Bath and Kitchen. If you're anything like us, you want to be able to trust a company while getting a great value.
That's why at Simple Bath and Kitchen, we focus on what really matters. You, value that's not hidden, and a team you can trust.
With designs that are tailored to your needs and honest, upfront pricing, we make your dream kitchen or bath attainable.
Discover the team Columbus has trusted over the last 15 years.
Simple Bath and Kitchen, where our home is your home.
SimpleBathandKitchen.com.